Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross.
Tracy, it seems like the word of the week is Philadelphia.
It's true.
You're looking at me like,
staring
yep.
at you. I was like, yeah, we've You're been like, talking about Philadelphia a lot, which makes sense because this week the Democrats are holding their convention there. And there's a lot of interesting exhibits and projects going on in conjunction with the exhibit. But there's also a lot of, I think, spotlight on the city of Philadelphia itself for being a major city that's dealing a lot with poverty.
That's right. And I think, you know, I can say, having lived in Philadelphia before D.C., I miss it every single day, my legal aid days. Something that I think a lot of people really just don't recognize is, in the words of WHYY, Philadelphia's NPR affiliate, Philly has the dubious distinction of being the poorest big city in the country. And so for that reason, we wanted to, as Talk Poverty Radio, take a look at what's going on in Philly on the ground, dig a little bit deeper than just the statistics of the percentage of people living in poverty or in deep poverty. And to do that, we're really, really pleased to have some amazing guests on the line from Philadelphia right now.
Yes, we're joined by Michelle Taylor, who's the program manager for Witnesses to Hunger, and we're also joined by Nike, who is a member of Witnesses to Hunger, who shares her own stories about living and experiencing poverty. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
So just kicking us off, tell us a little bit about Witnesses to Hunger. What is Witnesses? How did it get started? Philadelphia is a big part of that story.
Witnesses got started in 2008. It started out as a research project, and then it turned into this big advocacy work that we use photographs to tell our stories, to let people know what poverty looks like in America.
And Nike, you are one of the Witnesses to Hunger. The word witnesses itself is a distinctive and evocative word. What does the word mean in the title of the project?
It means to us that we witnesses, we experience hunger every day. We are the experts on what poverty is, and we are the experts on how to end poverty.
And a lot of what Witnesses does, and actually part of what you guys are involved in this week while the DNC is in Philadelphia, is actually taking pictures of your day-to-day experiences struggling to make ends meet so that people can actually walk through exhibits, photography exhibits that you put on that give them a glimpse into what your life and what the reality of poverty and hunger actually looks like on film. Michelle, tell us a little bit about the exhibit that you guys have going on right now in Philadelphia for the DNC. How is photography being used as an advocacy tool?
I mean, we have to understand the power of art when it's used for advocacy and for activism, right? And so we look at photography as art, and what these women have done is they've turned their lived experiences into like moving art, right? So what we've done is we've erected this exhibit where people can come in, they can see the pictures, they can read the quotations of the women's own stories about how the picture was taken. And then you'll also look up and you'll see what their demands are. We demand respect. We are hungry for food. We are hungry for safety. These are women making very powerful statements about their lives. And you're gonna see that. You're also gonna see their activism. We've got images of them actually testifying. And so the idea of being a witness is giving a testimony, right? So you imagine you're in court and you're swearing to tell the truth and the whole truth. And so they're giving a testimony of what life is like. And that's exactly what you're going to see in the exhibit.
Michelle, you're fairly new to Witnesses to Hunger in this current role. Can you tell us a bit about your background and what drew you to this organization?
Absolutely. I have been a social worker for about 15 years. I have worked primarily in New York City in housing, homelessness, and poverty. That's something I've always been drawn to and wanting to do my part to eradicate hunger and eradicate homelessness and poverty, right? I had gotten to a point where I wanted to leave New York, and Philadelphia is just one of my favorite cities. So I decided to come here. And as I was looking, I saw this job. And as someone who enjoys photography as a hobby, I thought that this was a really powerful movement. And when I realized that they wanted to go from having exhibits to actually being community advocates. And I'm a community organizer. I'm well known for that. So I figured I could come and lend my expertise and my help to help these women become even more empowered and to actually go into their communities and do the work themselves and help amplify their voices. That's what's really important to me.
And what was one of the most striking images in this exhibit for you?
You know, I was born into poverty and I grew up struggling. My mother was, you know, had to use food stamps growing up. We had rental assistance. There were times where, you know, we didn't really know where we were going to live. We, you know, there was all this stuff that I grew up with. When I first saw the exhibit, I had to step out of the room because it just really took me back to that. And I'm just so in awe. I think the image of, there's one image we have of a young child who is carrying a bag full of medicine. And you can see in her face that she's got some scarring and things like that. And it's a story of, like, how do people in poverty get the right health care for their children? And that is such a hot issue that we are just not talking about. Why are we not taking care of these children? You know what I mean? They need help, too. They need medical attention as well. So I think that that's the one that really struck. Anything that has the children in it really gets to me because I'm a mom myself.
Well, and you mentioned the connection between poverty and health and healthcare access. Mm-hmm. Some of what I think is probably worth discussing and that might not be widely known is that Witnesses to Hunger is a project that actually was started out of the Drexel School of Public Health. Mariana Chilton, who herself is a public health professional and a professor there at Drexel, she's the one who launched this project years ago. As Nike was describing. Tell us a little bit about how this was an outgrowth of public health work.
Sure. I mean, Mariana is very passionate about ending poverty and hunger, and anybody who knows her will know that. And I think that her work in really wanting to document and give voice to the people living in poverty has been so important. And that turned into the exhibit, right? And so the exhibit has been shown in D.C. and we've done it in Boston, and then the witnesses have gone before the U.N., they've gone before Congress, and now it's kind of like the witnesses were like, we want to do more. So it became an empowerment movement for them, and they said, we want to do something else. And so, you know, Mariana at the Center for Hunger-Free Communities, they sought grants, and we continue to seek grants so that the witnesses can form this community advocacy group and that they can go into the communities and do the work that they want to do for themselves and for their peers. And so that's pretty much how it all grew out of that.
Witnesses started, as you guys mentioned, in Philadelphia, but you've actually recently expanded to additional cities and states. What are some of the additional cities and states that have joined the Witnesses family, and what's the goal behind expanding beyond Philadelphia?
Sure. So we're in, I think, about 8 cities right now. We're in Boston, D.C., Baltimore, Camden is also included, New Haven, Scranton. And the idea is that, you know, there's people that are living in poverty everywhere. And we want to capture the experiences of as diverse a group as possible. And the idea behind expanding, I mean, one of the reasons why I was brought on is because there's a goal of reaching all 50 states. And the witnesses have told me that they want to have presence in all 50 states and create a nationwide network that has some power, that they can come together and say, for example, you know, with the cuts to SNAP, they can say, we, the Witnesses to Hunger, that have a presence in all 50 states, you know, demand a repeal of this. You know, they want to create a powerful kind of advocacy group support. So I'm here to help them do that. And so already we've had people showing interest in Chicago and Arkansas and Las Vegas and different places. We will have presence in all 50 states. That is the goal.
Nike, I want to bring you back into the discussion. So we mentioned at the top of the interview that the Democratic Convention is taking place in Philadelphia. And as a result, there have been images across the news of, you know, the beautiful arena that the events are taking place in and, you know, images of the Liberty Bell and some of the iconic shots of Philadelphia. But can you tell us what your Philadelphia is like and what people aren't understanding about what it means to live in poverty there?
The way our city is made, when people come to visit, for some reason they like to put up this facade as if there's no poverty in Philadelphia. There are homeless people, like when the Pope came, you didn't see not one homeless person on the street. I mean, it was crazy how they had somewhere for everyone, somewhere for everywhere everyone to go. However, one block away from the Liberty Bell, you'll see somebody on the street sleeping, needing somewhere to eat, needing something to eat, needing somewhere to sleep. Poverty is right in Philadelphia, and it is taking over. Unfortunately, we don't want to see it. We want to act like it don't exist. We don't want to stand up and be holding people accountable that it does exist. For some reason, when they come down here, they in their suits and they dress outfits, and they forget that it's children out here starving. It's veterans out here starving. It's senior citizens that can't get to these food pantries that are starving. So when you come to Philadelphia, I want everybody that comes to see what Philadelphia really is. And it's a city that needs education. It's a city that needs housing. It's a city that suffers from lack of health benefits for the mental. It's just so much going on in Philadelphia that is not being addressed as a whole.
And you're describing really two Philadelphias in a lot of ways. And, you know, as Tracy noted, when people come to the city, and whether it's for a convention or an event, they typically come to an area that's called Center City. It's where all the nice restaurants are. It's where, you know, the convention center is located. It's got, you know, lots of thriving business. And as you described, in many ways, is hiding what exists in other parts of the cities. Tell us about North Philadelphia, West Philadelphia, South Philadelphia, other areas that don't look like Center City.
Well, every other area don't look like Center City, except for maybe the greater Northeast, and like when you're on the borderline of other counties. Unfortunately, the city, you'll see abandoned houses. You'll see schools closed down. You'll see homeless people, from veterans all the way down to children and anything in between. You'll see the disabled. You'll see people standing in food pantries with a line that's like four blocks long. You'll see that people are really, really impoverished. You'll see that people are really struggling in America, especially in Philadelphia.
Can I add a bit to that as somebody who moved here from New York? I went to Penn undergrad, and I was in University City when I was here, and I did some volunteering in North Philly, and that's when I got a real taste of what Philadelphia was about, and I started feeling really guilty about going to the University of Pennsylvania because I knew the expansion that they were doing into West Philly. But when I moved back, I was very aware of the gentrification of North Philly and West Philly and these places, and I actually moved into North Philly. I moved it back into the hood because I didn't want to be a part of that, and I also, you know, I wanted to connect with the people that are living this life. If I'm doing this work, I wanted to live there. But one thing I will notice is that I'll point out that the lack of residential street cleaning, universal street cleaning, is a problem because they literally are forcing people in poverty to walk through garbage every single day, and they do nothing to clean it. And it's psychologically, that's a problem. And when Nike mentioned the abandoned buildings, that is psychological warfare, in my opinion. People in poverty are walking through all these abandoned buildings, and it's a feeling of desolation every single day. And I think that that's one of the things that I've been like really struck by moving back into the city coming from New York.
Michelle, you brought up an interesting point about your choice to live in North Philadelphia, because it sounds like you could live in different parts of the city. Mm-hmm. It seems like people who are maybe working class or middle class might have negative impressions of mm-hmm. lower income neighborhoods. What mm-hmm. do you think that people don't understand? Because, you know, creating mixed income neighborhoods are so mm-hmm. it's so challenging because people have
right.
misperceptions and fears of living, having low income neighbors.
Right. And that's unfortunate because low income people are pathologized as inherently violent. And that is a problem. I chose to live there because I wanted people that were going to say hello to me. As I was apartment hunting, I was staying in different parts of the city, and people were looking at me like I was weird. They would not talk to me, you know, anything. I came to North Philly immediately. Everybody was like, hey, how are you? You know, how are you doing? And I just felt that sense of community. There's one of the most beautiful churches I've seen in the world, and I've been to eight countries, and it is right in North Philadelphia. Do you think anybody's going to come and see that? It should be a historical landmark. It's beautiful. These are things that are happening in the communities. When things happen, I've seen at least like three different like community gatherings on my block alone. And one of them was a vigil for someone who was recently killed. But what I noticed was a strong sense of community and a commitment to each other. And that's something that's not being told about the people that are living in poverty in Philadelphia and other places. They love themselves, they love each other, and they want their communities to be better. And I've been sitting on my stoop, I've been talking with my neighbors. They have the same concerns as everyone else, and they want to participate in the improvement of Philadelphia and be included. That's what people really need to know. Instead, they're being shut out and they're being ignored, and that's a problem.
Digging in a little bit deeper into that, you know, some of the statistics at sort of top lines are what people are hearing about poverty this week while the DNC is in Philadelphia. Roughly a quarter of Philadelphians are living in poverty. About half of those are living in what's called deep poverty, which is defined as earning less than half of the federal poverty line. We're talking about, you know, one parent with two kids having $10,000 a year or less. And these are catastrophic numbers that put Philadelphia, you know, way, way, way at the bottom when it comes to the state of poverty in cities across the country. But what you're talking about is something that is very different from, I think, probably a lot of the perceptions and myths out there about who are people who are struggling to make ends meet every day. Nike, tell us a little bit about the work that witnesses do, not just through Witnesses to Hunger, but in your communities along the lines of what Michelle was describing.
Well, in the communities, we feed children free lunches. We volunteer a lot of times at the food pantries. We go to all kinds of community service events just to try to uplift each other, because every day it's just a fight just to survive. And then you have, it's just like everything comes at us at once. We're fighting the government. We're fighting people. We're fighting each other. Like, at the end of the day, I feel like we are so misunderstood. We are so misjudged. We just judge wrong all the way around. Witnesses want to kill the stereotypes of what poverty looks like. We want you to understand that we're educated, that we want more. We don't want a handout. We want the same opportunities as everyone else. Unfortunately, we're just looked upon as less than human. And our job is to change that.
And Nike, you mentioned the education. I know that you're working on completing your degree. Can you tell us just a bit more about your personal story and what you're currently doing?
Okay, a short, brief personal story. I'm a survivor of incest. I'm a survivor of gun violence. I'm a survivor of homelessness. And I never finished high school because I had got shot at the age of 14. And unfortunately, I was not able to attend school because I was really, really just trying to make it and live. Then I moved with my biological father, who had raped me. And then shortly after, when I was able to walk again, I ran away. And I was homeless for a short period of time until I got on my feet. So when I went to Drexel University to take a friend of mine to take the test, the only way I could drive her home was to stay. I had to take the test, the exam myself. And the funny thing was, I had passed and she didn't. And she forced me to go to Drexel. And even though the first two semesters I flunked out, when I went back, now I'm only 45 credits away from my bachelor's. But unfortunately, the debt that I owe to Drexel is about $2,200. And living on disability is hard to pay this debt off. So it's like put a little damper on my goals, but I'm still going after my goals.
Nike, if you watch Fox News, and you're probably not surprised to hear that I don't watch a lot of Fox News. You get the impression that people who are poor are poor because they are sitting on their couch eating, quote, bonbons all day, receiving some check from the government. What is the reality of the reasons that people, you, your friends and colleagues in the Witnesses Program, people in Philadelphia, what are the real reasons that people are struggling to make ends meet?
First of all, a lot of times we're not dealt this hand. We're given this hand, and we play it to the fullest, to our potential. We don't ask to be in poverty. A lot of this is generational cycles passed down from generation to generation. Us as witnesses want to change that and break the cycle of poverty and hunger, starting with us so we don't pledge this down to our children. A lot of times we work harder than people that work. Some of us have 2 and 3 jobs just to try to make ends meet. We strategize on how to make it throughout the 30 days when SNAP benefits are running out. Unfortunately, they have this image of us as lazy, like you said, eating bonbons, but that's further from the truth. We're the most hardest working people there are because we just have to survive, which is a job within itself.
And I think it's clear from your story that you shared with us, and thank you for sharing it so candidly, that despite all of the barriers in your way, you're doing everything that politicians say that you're supposed to be doing, working hard, getting an education. And obviously, the way that our economy is set up, the system set up, it's just not enough, that there's still more barriers. This question is for both of you. You know, given that we're in the middle of a presidential election, what do you hope to see the next president do with regard to poverty in this country?
First, I would like to see that they be honest with themselves. A lot of times, they live in denial of what poverty is. They're so quick to throw poverty under the rug like it doesn't play a central part of America. I keep trying to explain to people that have power that you're no stronger than your weakest link. And until you understand that poverty can be addressed and you need to address it and stop overlooking it and pushing it under the table, America is doomed. It's falling at a rapid rate. And the problem I have, honestly, is that we elect y'all in to office and y'all never keep your word. So I'm looking into seeing what we can do, because if we hire you, we should be able to fire you. I feel that anytime you say you're going to do something, I need a notarized statement for my vote. I need to know that you're going to do what you're going to say you're going to do, and I can hold you accountable.
This is Michelle. I believe that poverty is man-made, and it is sustained, and it is systemic, and it's going nowhere. And I think in order for the wealthy to have value to their dollars, they have to maintain poverty. My thing is, I want the next president to acknowledge the connection between poverty and race, and between class and race issues. And I want people to understand that the way we address poverty among white people, particularly in rural areas, is with more compassion and empathy than we do for Black and Latino people that are living in the inner cities. For some reason, we have pathologized those people as being lazy and deserving of poverty because they make it themselves, whereas when it comes to white people living in poverty, we feel like they've fallen on hard times and we show more empathy. So I want the next president to address our racist issues that are dealing with poverty, our classism, and the fact that there are policies that could be pushed to alleviate the struggles of people that are living in poverty, because I have a very cynical understanding that they're not going to do much about it anytime soon.
And clearly there are policies that are in the public discourse right now that could help, like raising the minimum wage, but some politicians say that the wage is too high. What are your reactions to those sorts of arguments? Obviously, everything you laid out, we would hope politicians take what you said seriously. But what about the politicians that are making statements like that the wage is too high already?
Well, those are the politicians who understand that American capitalism was founded on not having to pay for labor costs. So when you factor in a whole system based around not having to pay for labor costs because you relied on the labor of enslaved people, it's hard to get to a place where you actually feel it's important to pay workers for the work that they do. And so when someone says the wages are too high, what they're saying is that I really wish we could go back to a time where we didn't have to pay these people at all and they would just work for us. So I find that to be one of the most patronizing, disgusting statements ever. Yes, raising the minimum wage will help. Making it a living wage will help. But also understanding that living wages vary vary from city to city and state to state. What does it mean in terms of the cost of living, right? So if you give someone $15 an hour in New York City, that's very different from $15 in Little Rock, Arkansas, right? So we have to adjust for that. It's not that simple. People talk about flat taxes or things like that. It's not that simple, okay? What they need to do is to not cut SNAP benefits. They need to, you know, raise the age for WIC from 5 to 6. We have some children that can't get into school at age 5 because they were born later in the year. It needs to go up to 6. We need to make it less dehumanizing to go and apply for these benefits, okay? We have witnesses and people who are going to these offices, sitting there for hours and hours, feeling so completely dehumanized just because they're seeking help, right? In America, we have this individualism that when you seek help, there's something wrong with you, and that's not right. We're supposed to be a community. We're supposed to look out for each other. So I'd like to see all of those kinds of things addressed on a policy level, and we can fight that at the local level. We can go to the states, and we can go to the cities and work on those things, and that's what people like the witnesses are going to be doing.
And in the last minute that we have with you both, what takeaway do you hope that both the elected officials and all of the folks who are attending the convention this week in Philadelphia have, whether they see your exhibit or not?
I would like for them to take into account that when they make any policies, that they inform, have people that live in poverty every day sit in and help make the decisions on what works and what doesn't work. Unfortunately, a lot of the politicians never even lived in poverty or know what poverty is. So I think the only way to get to the root of the issue is to actually network and communicate with the people that are living it every single day, and they are the experts.
And I want people to remember that even when you're saying 26% of Philadelphians live in poverty and 13% are in deep poverty, we can quote those statistics, but these are still human beings. And we have to remember that people are human beings. They are not social statuses. They are not socioeconomic classes. They are human beings who wake up every single day. They draw breath. They pump blood. They raise children. They want to be happy. And so when we talk about poverty, we can talk about the statistics, and that's cool, but we have to always remember these are human beings.
Michelle Taylor is the program manager for Witnesses to Hunger, and Nike is a member of Witnesses to Hunger in Philadelphia. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis, and joining me next to continue our discussion of Philadelphia, the poorest big city in the United States, and what the reality of poverty on the ground there is Sharon Dietrich. She's the litigation director at Community Legal Services in Philadelphia. And as listeners of the show know, my former boss, my honorary big sis. Sis, how you doing?
Hey, I'm well. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. I think you're a little busy this week. You've got some guests in town.
Yes, it feels not like a normal week here in Philadelphia.
I'm really excited to have you on to help us kind of continue to dig into the reality of poverty on the ground in Philadelphia, what it looks like. You know, we heard some of the statistics earlier in the episode about the poverty rates in Philly, the deep poverty rates in Philly, but kind of getting away from statistics, help us put a face on what poverty in Philadelphia looks like.
So what you find in Philadelphia is that there are a large number of people who have inadequate income, in a shocking number of cases, zero income, zero cash income. And that's either because they don't have jobs or don't have jobs that pay them enough, or they don't have public benefits, or their public benefits don't provide enough of a cash safety net for them to get along. So that is the thing that all of the low-income folks that I represent here at CLS have in common, that they just all have really low income.
Well, there's been a lot of discussion in the last year, 2 years, in part because of a book, Living on $2 a Day, Kathy Eden and Luke Schaefer, two sociologists who have really helped to put a face on and also to quantify the reality of extreme poverty in the United States. That's definitely been a narrative that's gotten a lot of airtime, but you're actually describing something that in some cases is even worse than living on $2 a day. You're talking about people who have zero cash income. What does that even really mean, and how can people find themselves in the United States and in Philadelphia in that situation?
Yeah, and I don't want to make it sound like it's an outlier, that there's a person here or there. There are many people who have zero income and, in fact, would be happy to have $2 a day. Maybe, you know, they're scraping together a little bit of money through doing work that is very episodic and sporadic. I mean, for instance, I do not cease to be amazed by how many people get their income by picking up basically cans off the sidewalk and turning them in for the money they can get for the tin. So you're talking about people who are really at their wits' end in terms of making it work. And I got to say, I admire the hell out of them, because you have to have a lot of ingenuity to get through life when you have zero income. And people are doing that.
Now, obviously, a piece of the picture here is there not being enough jobs, as you mentioned, and not being enough jobs for low-wage workers who have qualifications in perhaps certain fields, or a lack of qualifications that will help them get their foot in the door of the labor market. But before we get into the jobs piece of the picture, I just sort of want to put up the straw man and then tee you up to pull him down. If Paul Ryan were sitting here conducting this interview with you, well, I don't know. Maybe I don't know if you would have said yes. I won't force you to go on record and answer that question. But if Speaker Ryan were sitting here conducting this interview, he would probably pose back, well, wait a second. We've got this, generous safety net out there. There's no such thing as people living on $0 a day or no cash income. They've got, programs out there that are designed to help protect them when they fall on hard times. Why is that not what's happening among your clients or among the residents of Philadelphia?
Well, let me say to start that if Speaker Ryan calls from my phone number, please give it to him. And I would say, secondly, that Speaker Ryan knows better. There are other people who do not. There, I know, is a sense out there. Some of my friends, my own personal friends, think, well, there are too many people on welfare. Rebecca, there's hardly anyone on welfare. That is the big change of the last 20 years, that welfare is basically dead on the vine. There still is a federal program, TANF, that provides cash assistance benefits for families with children. But the first qualifier there is families with children. So if you do not have children, you don't qualify for TANF. And the TANF program has become so threadbare in all states, I would say, not just here, that there are so few people who get any cash benefits from it anymore. Just to give you a few reasons there, in Pennsylvania, when welfare reform went into effect about 20 years ago, the federal block grant to the state for welfare was $719 million. Today, the block grant is still $719 million. And because it was block granted, essentially a lot of the money started to get spent on things other than cash assistance, some of which were good, some of which were maybe less good. But the fact is there's just not a whole lot of money left to pay for cash benefits. And benefits in the state of Pennsylvania, which my clients would qualify for, have not increased since 1990. They are, for a family of three, $403 a month. $403 a month. So for a lot of families, that's hardly even worth applying for, or they quickly become disqualified if they have any earned income at all. And because of that, there's been a 63% decrease in the TANF caseload since welfare reform started 20 years ago.
But there's a related program when people talk about, quote, welfare that gets a lot less airtime, right? Particularly we're celebrating or not celebrating, perhaps, you know, commemorating with really mixed feelings, the 20th anniversary of TANF next month. But a program that almost never gets talked about and where there's a real story in Pennsylvania that needs to be told is something called general assistance. Tell me a little bit about GA. What happened in Pennsylvania? What have been the after effects of the changes in that program in the last few years?
So general assistance was the state-funded program that provided cash benefits for people who did not qualify for the federal benefits, mostly single people who had disabilities. At least that was the last iteration of it. There was a time back when I was in law school decades ago where the GA program in Pennsylvania actually provided benefits across the board if you had no other income. And we're not talking big benefits here. People were getting $205 a month for general assistance. But the program was whittled down over time so that the first reduction brought it down to primarily people with disabilities and not able-bodied people who were unfortunate enough not to have any other income. But in 2012, the General Assembly in Pennsylvania eliminated the program entirely. And I understand that that happened in other states as well at about the same time, I guess in the post-recession state budget jam-ups. And so lots of folks who were living on $205 a month of income now have zero. And that unquestionably, from my perspective, has added substantially to the poverty that the city and its residents are experiencing these days.
Now, another program that, again, isn't really talked about all that much, but that, you know, some people might sit here and say, well, wait a second, if people are out of work, aren't they able to get unemployment insurance? Why aren't people able to collect UI when they're out of work? Why is that not the source of protection that one might think it would be if there are these large numbers of people who are sitting on the sidelines, as you describe?
So 2012 was a bad year for all kinds of public benefits programs. And our unemployment program in Pennsylvania served us reasonably well during the Great Recession. We've always had a strong program in Pennsylvania, probably in part because Pennsylvania has a strong history of organized labor, which is a sound proponent of that program. But as many other states did, we ran out of funds in our unemployment insurance trust fund during the recession and had to borrow several billion dollars from the federal government in order to keep the program afloat. So to rectify that situation, the General Assembly passed legislation that made some tweaks to financial eligibility for that program, what your earning record needed to look like to qualify for those benefits. And with that one stroke of the pen, 48,000 people a year found their benefits eliminated, 10% of the caseload, in order to reduce the amount of spending. That is similar to what has gone on in other states coming out of the recession, that programs have been slashed, unemployment programs have been slashed. As a great paper that's come out of your shop has talked about recently, it's a program in dire need of being fixed. But here, 10% of the applicants a year are now ineligible who would have been eligible the year before.
And if the most recent analysis remains true at this point, just 1 in 4 jobless workers in the United States are even able to access unemployment insurance. So as you note, definitely not limited to Philadelphia.
Well, actually, I should tell you that even with these huge cuts, Pennsylvania still ranks about 4th in the country in percentage of unemployed workers that are covered by our program. So that tells you how awful it is in places like North Carolina, Florida, where the programs almost don't exist anymore.
Now, you mentioned a kind of a broad array of folks who are in many cases living without any forms of cash income. We haven't talked about food stamps and the critical safety net that that provides, but there was actually some good news coming out of Pennsylvania last year with regard to public benefits, one of the rare glimpses of glimmers of hope, and that came from Medicaid expansion.
Yes, Pennsylvania did finally enact Medicaid expansion in 2005. I guess it was passed in 2014. I'm sorry, I said 2005, I meant 2015. It was enacted by the General Assembly in 2014 and went into effect last year. And that has helped tremendously expand who was covered by health insurance in Pennsylvania. So thank goodness for that.
Now, I would be remiss if I didn't bring us back to the jobs conversation, right? We've been talking a little bit about kind of, you know, the facts, taking down that myth or that kind of broad scale misperception that there's this huge welfare state that's there to pick people up when they fall on hard times. But sort of back to the jobs piece, tell me a little bit about why there aren't enough jobs, right? I mean, we know why there aren't enough jobs, kind of broadly speaking, but give me the Philadelphia perspective. What are the types of work that people are doing who are lucky enough to have even low-wage work? But sort of what is the labor market for your client population and for the population of folks who are struggling to make ends meet look like?
So the employment economy of Philadelphia is often described as meds and eds. We have many, many hospitals. We have many, many institutions of higher learning. And a huge percentage of all of Philadelphia and the region's population work in meds and eds. So I would say that easily the most important industry for our clients for work is the healthcare industry. And I mean that broadly to include not only hospitals, but also nursing homes, home health care, the latter being especially on the rise with the desire to keep people in their homes at a cheaper and at a better quality of life. Drug and alcohol programs, mental health programs, certified nursing assistants, that's probably the major category that our clients are working in. We also have a lot of folks who work in the hospitality industry, whether it's the hotels or Philadelphia is now a restaurant mecca, and lots of folks are working there in the back kitchen. Obviously, there are lots of different jobs, but those, I would say, are the primary ones my clients are working in. And then, as I said, there's that whole group of folks who are not working in formal jobs at all, but are hustling to try to come up with some cash to get some Subway tokens or put some food in their mouths. We did some work, you and I did some work back in the day representing people who were being chased for court fines, and I never ceased to be amazed how many people told the judge when they were trying to get into a payment plan that their income accounted was for picking up cans. And I remember one client very vividly whose version of that was that the neighbors were paying him to pick up dog poop. So people are going to extraordinary lengths in order to bring some income into their households.
So when you watch, as I'm sure a lot of our listeners have been doing voraciously, as have you and I and you know fellow nerds nationwide, the coverage of the convention in Philly, you see a bustling city. You see a beautiful, gleaming convention center. You see Wells Fargo. You see lots of action on the streets and doubtless many, many thousands of people working in a booming hospitality industry. How can it be then that there aren't enough jobs?
How can it be that there aren't enough jobs? Well, they're not jobs necessarily geared towards the skills of the low-wage workers. And even for the jobs that exist, one of the major reasons people are not in those jobs is because they have criminal records. And that issue makes up the grist for my daily mill. The employment unit that I head here at Community Legal Services sees about 1,600 new clients a year. And of that 1,600 new clients who have some kind of employment-related issue, 1,000 are here dealing with their criminal records because that's what's keeping them from getting jobs. So going back to the issue of healthcare being our major industry, if you have a criminal record, chances are very good that you're going to be screened out of working as a CNA, or at least in a lot of settings. So, you know, where there used to be 50 years ago de facto race discrimination that kept people out of jobs, what I see now is that the racial impact of having a criminal record is really having the same resulting unemployment in communities of color.
So we've painted, or, well, you, let me blame you, you've painted quite a dire doom and gloom situation in the city of Philadelphia. But I want to pivot to talk a little bit about solutions. While there is a whole cast of policymaker and elected official characters in town, you and a lot of other advocates for cutting poverty and hunger and for boosting employment rates are all working on and trying to elevate a whole host of policy solutions. What are the fixes? What do you hope that folks who are in Philadelphia right now hear and take away with them in terms of how we can move the needle?
All right. Well, let me start on the job side, because the honest to God's truth is that almost all of my clients want to work. No matter what source of income they have, no matter what their barriers are, people really want to work. They understand that that is the best way for them to try to stabilize their lives and get ahead. So the initiative that we're excited about advocating for here, both at the city level and at the state level, is that we would love to see some subsidized jobs programs. If there aren't enough jobs that our clients can get into despite their dogged efforts to get there, let's make a program that funds people to work in jobs that private employers will not hire them for. And currently we're looking at existing funding sources like workforce development money, reentry money, the TANF welfare money, the block grant, as potential sources for funding such a program. But we'd certainly like to see a program at the national level that would do the same and provide a funding stream to basically allow people who want to work to be able to work. So that is a key thing.
And this isn't a new idea, just to jump in, right? I mean, this is, you mentioned TANF. This is an idea we've discussed a number of times on this show, because hugely successful at the height of the Great Recession, there was a program put in place through the TANF Emergency Fund that actually put 260-some thousand Americans back to work in jobs that would not, in most cases, have otherwise existed. There was a program that that you spearheaded and that I had the pleasure of working on with you when I was in Philadelphia, called Way to Work Philadelphia, and there was a state program, Way to Work Pennsylvania, that actually leveraged exactly the model that you're talking about right now.
That's right, and that wasn't the first time. Before that, in the welfare reform days, there was a program called the Transitional Work Corporation that we had here in Philadelphia that was extraordinarily successful at moving people from welfare to work. CLS has employees on staff who came to us through that program who are still working for us. Before that, it was CETA. Before that, it was WPA. So the country has a history of having government-funded or at least subsidized jobs, and I think at this point that's a very necessary piece of the menu for addressing these problems.
Now, for the people who want to work, but who maybe have criminal records, as you were describing, you guys also have been leaders statewide and also nationally in advocating for solutions there as well. Tell me a little bit about what you think some of the fixes for that population might be.
So, given how huge a problem criminal records barriers are, we could have a whole show just to, based on that.
And maybe we should. I will take that as a pitch.
Maybe we will. Okay. But let me go straight to what I think is the single most important fix, policy fix, for the criminal record barrier problem, which is essentially to help people clear their records. There's now a lot of social science research that says that if you desist from crime for a lengthy period of time, you are no more likely to commit another crime than the person next to you on the street. In other words, your risk declines to the same as everybody else. And if only everybody would accept that, all employers would say, oh, sure, you've gone 10 years without a conviction, come work for me. That's just not the way it is, even though there's some laws that support your right to do that. So our primary goal is to try to seal or expunge as many records as possible. And the concept that we've been lucky to work with you on for the last year or so is the idea of a clean slate, an automatic sealing of minor criminal records that are old, and also non-convictions. Let's do it in a mass way to help as many people as possible.
And just as a shameless plug, this is another area you and I have done a lot of work on. Pennsylvania is actually leading the way with a clean slate proposal that would do exactly what you're describing.
It has bipartisan support, as it should everywhere. I hope that we get this done, and I hope we're the first of many.
I do as well. And hopefully that's part of what we'll get to cover on this episode that is solely focused on criminal records that you have pitched. So for folks, though, who are working, and this is, you know, a big piece of the puzzle, right, is people who are working maybe two jobs, three jobs. We heard a little bit earlier in the episode from Nike about that as a reality among people in Philadelphia, and of course, not just in Philly alone, who are working incredibly hard, but who are still having real trouble making ends meet. What would raising the minimum wage mean for Philadelphians?
If the minimum wage were raised to $10.10 an hour, forget $15 an hour, which we would love to see, but even if it were raised to $10.10, 130,000 Philadelphians would get a wage increase. So while some folks are working above minimum wage, there are many who are simply not even getting to the threshold of $10 an hour.
Now, we talked a little bit earlier about TANF and general assistance and the reality of those programs. And I should really say the reality of those program, because there is no general assistance program anymore. But what would the asks be of policymakers with respect to cash assistance programs such as those?
Well, again, we could probably have a whole show about fixing the welfare programs, but let's just say that to start with, the idea that the TANF grant has not increased since 1990 is just shameful. Imagine if your salary had not increased since 1990. Well, of course, you were probably not even thinking about a salary in 1990, but that tells you how long this problem has been going on of these benefits that have been stalled. The TANF grant amount has to be increased to provide a little bit of a safety net, at least, since now it's nothing almost. And there needs to be a replacement program for general assistance. I don't know that it needs to be general assistance. You could have, for instance, a housing voucher case, or a housing voucher is an alternative source of funds, but something that will help replace those lost cash benefits for folks, even if they are earmarked to a specific need like housing.
And one of the issues that you have been a leader on, and that CLS more broadly has been a leader on, but which almost never gets talked about because it is thoroughly unsexy, and I say that in the context of so much else that we talk about on this show that is not sexy but that needs airtime, and that's the role of the agencies that actually administer these programs, the concept of bureaucratic disentitlement, people who get gummed up in the red tape and are never able to access programs that they're actually eligible for, and in some cases by design, and that's often why those kinds of policies and red tape can be put in place by people who are not hugely supportive of those programs in the first place. Tell me a little bit about the role that inadequate administrative funding of key agencies that are charged with running these programs that we've been describing plays, and some of the work that you guys at CLS do to try to support those agencies.
So the public benefit systems, whether it's the welfare department or the unemployment department or even Social Security, are so underfunded for administrative purposes right now that sometimes they absolutely freeze up. They basically can't function. As somebody who's trying to deal with them, you can't get them on the phone. You can't get through to them. People go to the welfare office, make a day-long trek to the welfare office to get their claims benefit issues straightened out. You can't do that in the unemployment system because there is no office to go to. You can only reach them by phone. And so we've had to do a lot of advocacy through threats of lawsuits and even sometimes teaming up with the agencies to say, hey, there's got to be more cash here. We helped to get the Pennsylvania General Assembly to pass a supplemental bill to fund the unemployment system because the legislators were all upset that their constituents couldn't get through to the unemployment office.
And tell me a little bit about that piece, right? I mean, because like put a face on what happens when the unemployment agency doesn't have enough money. What are the consequences for jobless workers?
You don't have enough people to answer the phone. People can go for days calling and calling and calling and not getting through. Imagine that you're unemployed and desperately in need of your check, and some snafu has developed with it that you don't really understand, but it means that the money is not being deposited in your account anymore, and you're desperately trying to reach them to figure out how to make it right, and you can't get through. There were in the unemployment system a few years ago what sometimes were called bat phones, which were at the workforce development sites and went directly through to the unemployment offices rather than through the switchboard. People would line up for the day to get on the bat phone to talk to their unemployment worker, fist fights in line, waiting to get through. So that is the level of chaos we have with our administrative agencies now.
So one other kind of newsy development out of Philadelphia that didn't receive, at least in my opinion, enough national attention is that you guys recently enacted a soda tax specifically to fund universal pre-K. And this happened about a month ago. It's going to move forward and take effect in January of 2017. I'll speak for myself that I have some reservations about the revenue generation mechanism here, given that a soda tax is highly regressive on your clients and struggling individuals more generally, but obviously a hugely positive outcome when it comes to expanding access, ensuring access to early childhood education. Tell me a little bit about how that came to pass, and sort of your thoughts on how that fits in with the broader landscape of trying to fight poverty in Philadelphia.
So when our current mayor, Mayor Jim Kenney, was elected last fall, he ran in large part on the promise of getting this soda tax done to fund universal pre-K. And it was a battle royale because there were a lot of vested interests that were not in favor of the soda tax. It's expected to decrease soda consumption, which the health people say that's a good outcome as well as pre-K. But ultimately, it did pass. And whether or not you think it's the right funding mechanism, and Rebecca, we could have yet another show about tax policy.
That's three pitches you've made. I'm writing them down.
Revenue generation in this country is a mess. So you could argue that it's a regressive tax and the wrong way to go, and I hear you on that. But what you can't argue about is with the value of enhanced early childhood education.
Sharon Dietrich is the litigation director at Community Legal Services in Philadelphia, a.k.a. the epicenter of the Democratic National Convention this week. Sharon, thank you, as always, for taking the time. And I look forward to catching up with you off the air as well.
Thanks, Rebecca. It was great to talk with you about these issues.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford because my block ain't safe. I spend most of my